It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the recent release of Instagram Threads could put Twitter in trouble. We'll talk to a social media expert about the new text-based social media platform and whether it's actually here to stay. First, growing up in the Midwest, I remember learning the history of the region something like this. There were Native Americans here before European settlers came, but then American and European immigrants came in the 1800s and settled a mostly empty, unpopulated wilderness. If you look at maps of the history of the region, you can see Wisconsin as a French possession, then a British territory, then part of the newly created United States, even though the indigenous population was larger than the European population until well into the 1800s. Our next guest says there's a huge story hidden by commonly held views of history, of efforts to expand the boundaries of American statehood by taking land from Native Americans, and of resistance to those efforts by the indigenous people of Wisconsin and the wider Midwest. In his new book, he tells the story of treaties made and violated, land stolen and sold, and the Native leaders, U.S. government officials, and others in the middle of the story. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about indigenous tribes and the colonization of Wisconsin? What do you remember learning about that period in history? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Michael Witkin is a professor in the Department of History and the Center for the Study of Ethnicity and Race at Columbia University. He's a citizen of the Red Cliff Band of Lake Superior Ojibwe. His latest book is called Seeing Red, Indigenous Land, American Expansion, and the Political Economy of Plunder in North America. It was named a Pulitzer Prize finalist this year. Michael, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Can you talk about this effort that's at the heart, I think, of your book, correcting this gap that I certainly grew up with in my understanding of the history of our region?
Yeah, I think the way you phrased it here at the beginning, that thinking about the history of Wisconsin, or at least the non-native history, as a colonial history, as a history of this colonization of Wisconsin, I think that's kind of new to most people. And I think that's one of the things that I wanted to recover, that this wasn't a state or a continent that was sort of empty and settled by pioneers who tamed a wilderness, but rather it was an indigenous continent, and its settlement by non-native people was an act of colonization.
The idea from even before the United States became a country that was at the heart of this seems to be, okay, we English, the English settlers, we define use of land in this way. A person holds title to this piece of land and improves it. And Native Americans aren't doing that, not in the way we'd expect. That, therefore, that gives us, the English, and then the Americans, the right to take that land. That seems to be at the heart of so much of westward expansion, including here in what was the Northwest Territory.
Absolutely. I mean, so this is the sort of idea of discovery, or sometimes called the doctrine of discovery. And this is the idea that when Europeans arrive in the Americas, and in North America in particular, that they found a new world, and that new world was, for all intents and purposes, uninhabited because it didn't have sort of recognizable forms of property or private property like you would have in Western Europe. And with that as a sort of framework, the original colonial project allowed monarchs from Europe to say, I've discovered this land, it's unsettled, and therefore I can claim it by right of discovery. The right of discovery becomes a way in which they grant the crown charters to colonies in the Eastern Seaboard. There's the Seven Years' War, where the two competing empires, France and Great Britain, compete with one another. France loses. They cede their claims to North America to the British. And following the Revolution, at the settlement of that war, the British Empire cedes huge swaths of North America to the United States, all through this idea about a right of discovery, that they were essentially passing land that had been claimed because it was unsettled by kings, claimed as a possession, incorporated into empire, and then transferred to the Republic. And so the Republic basically takes up that same ideological project, the idea that the territory in the west of the Appalachian Mountains that had been granted to it by the Treaty of Paris that ends the Revolution is unsettled land, and the U.S. sets out to kind of settle that. And the story of Wisconsin is totally wrapped up in that process, the settlement where the United States has to come to grips with the fact that the land is not empty, that it's occupied by Native people, and that settling isn't just a matter of moving settlers onto a forest and changing it, but rather engaging with Native people and then actively sort of working to colonize them and their land.
We operated under this Northwest Ordinance here in the Northwest Territory that included Wisconsin. Can you talk about what that was and how it set the stage for how that land would be taken and then distributed?
Sure. So the Northwest Ordinance is the way by which the United States figures out what to do with it. So when we come out of the Revolution, all this land, really from the Appalachian Mountains out to the Mississippi, the United States regards as part of its public domain. That is, it's the land that I mentioned had been transferred by the Great Britain to the United States. It's not settled by Americans. Therefore, they consider it public land that's controlled by the federal government. And they decide the way to settle that orderly with the Northwest Ordinance, which is a land law. And the ordinance is a way that you can both organize territory and that will eventually become a state, and then also sell the land within that territory. And the way the Northwest Ordinance works is that when you get 5,000 free white men, that's enough to organize a space as a territory. So the territory of Michigan or the territory of Indiana. Once the territory is organized, the progression goes from 5,000 free white men to 60,000 free white settlers. When you've reached the 60,000 population mark, the territory can petition the federal government to enter the Union as a state with its own constitution. And then it enters the Union as a state with all the rights and privileges that other states. And so that's the model that's used in order to create territories, turn the Northwest Territory into specific territories, the states that are now Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, Michigan, Wisconsin, and parts of Minnesota were all part of the original Northwest Territory. And for the most part, in the southern tier of the Northwest Territories, Indiana, Ohio, Illinois, they fill up really fast. And they reach the requisite population of 60,000 persons to become states and enter the Union all within the early 1800s. Ohio is a state in 1803. Illinois and Indiana, I think, are 1808 and 1818, respectively, have become states in the Union. And it's in part because those territories are all connected to the Ohio River, to the Mississippi, and the Mississippi connects that territory to the sort of larger market economy of the U.S., New Orleans, St. Louis. And so it makes sense if you want to be a farmer in Ohio or in Illinois, you can get your product to a market than a U.S. market. But above the Ohio River, what would now be, say, Michigan and Ohio territory, it makes a lot less sense to settle. And so those territories actually remain territories for a long time. Michigan territory, which is formed in 1805, actually stays a territory, doesn't get the 60,000 population threshold until 1837. And Wisconsin isn't even organized as a territory until 1837. Before that time, it's part of Michigan. And as late as 1820, the Michigan territory, which would have been Michigan now, plus Wisconsin, plus Minnesota, had less than 20,000 non-native settlers. And that's, you know, going into 1820. So that's really late. It's not till the Erie Canal is completed and opens in 1826 that it begins to make sense to start moving into these more northern parts of the Northwest Territory, because only then can you start getting things like agricultural products or timber out to a market in the U.S.
Talking to Michael Witkin about his book, Seeing Red, Indigenous Land, American Expansion, and the Political Economy of Plunder in North America. You can join in if you have questions at 800-642-1234. Michael, a huge part of the story you tell is of how natives in Wisconsin and beyond reacted to this drive to populate the states with settlers from out east. What were some of the key points in the story you researched?
There's several key points. There's an important treaty in 1837 that cedes a huge swath of Wisconsin, now is Wisconsin, I think something around the nature of 11 million acres. And it's a treaty that the indigenous peoples tell American officials they don't want to cede. And there's not a lot of population pressure in 1837 for that northern Wisconsin territory. But the U.S. basically tells the native people that they have to cede it or it'll be taken from them. And so they do. And they are compensated something about, I think, in the nature of around 13 cents per acre, which the U.S. can then turn around and sell through the Northwest Ordinance for $1 an acre, so making an enormous amount of profit. And then that property often enters into circulation and becomes private property of individuals who sit on it and don't necessarily develop it right away, and maybe sit on it for 10 or 15 years where it can still sell for, say, $80 an acre. So you have this sort of massive transfer of land and wealth from native people to the federal government. And then the transfer of that land as a public domain to the individual settlers in the United States, basically at a subsidized way of settling the settlement, because you can sell that land at a way below market rate because the government has a monopoly when they acquire it from native people. So it's a it's a process where you're sort of facilitating the colonization by creating a sort of a monopoly on land sales and then making that land available in a really really affordable manner to most people in order to encourage immigration.
And that's at the heart of the idea of plunder you introduce, actually, even in the subtitle of your book. Can you talk about the scope of a financial benefit to the United States, individuals, and to the federal government of that sort of forced appropriation of land and then distribution of it?
This was one of the things that really was a surprise for me. And if you think about the United States and the histories we all get in elementary school and junior high school and high school, these standard kind of survey histories, when you get to the early Republic, where you tend to find Indians in that history in a standard survey is with the Trail of Tears, the really tragic removal of Native peoples from what would then be the Southeast. You can think places like Georgia, North Carolina, the Alabama, Mississippi, the Trail of Tears. That's pretty common. And that makes sense with the story. There's a hunger for land. Indians are facing pressure. They're removed. You don't have that in the Northwest Territories. I mean, to some extent, Ohio, Illinois, Indiana, as I said, fill up really quick. But the land in territories like Michigan and Wisconsin, there's just less demand for it. And because there's less demand for it, the federal government sort of needs to entice people to move in. And what ends up happening is rather than having a pressure to remove Indians, people in states like Michigan and Wisconsin quickly discover that having Indians in place, this sort of colonized subject, is way more lucrative than kicking them off and taking over their land. And I say it's more lucrative because the treaty process, this treaty process where federal representatives of the federal government come in, negotiate with tribal members, often through people that are traders or Indian agents. And most of the traders and Indian agents are intermarried with the tribe, so they have indigenous wives and children. And they negotiate these treaties to cede land in exchange for a payment of money. I mentioned that before with the 1837 treaty. So you get a $20,000 cash payment for 10 years for the sale of this 13 million acres. But when that payment is made, and the federal officials would show up with specie, with actual currency, which is often rare in early 19th century America, that payout usually went something in the neighborhood of 90% or more to traders or merchants who would claim that Native peoples owed them debt from the fur trade. And debt that hadn't been repaid. And so each of these payments that were coming in to compensate Native people for the sale of land by a forced treaty, the money for that would mostly not end up in Native hands. It would mostly end up in the hands of merchants, traders, agents, people who were engaged in this fur trade. They would take that money and invest in their business, develop it in that way. The same merchants who were claiming that that money's debt would also be hired out by the government. Part of the payment was a cash payment in compensation for the land cession, but part of it was, say, $10,000 in provisions and goods. The federal government would buy those from the same merchants who were claiming it as debt. So they're making money by claiming the cash as debt. They're making money by covering the provisions that are also part of the annual payment for land sales by providing that to the federal government. So basically, you've got the sort of the leaders of the Wisconsin Territory, the Michigan Territory, often people who are connected with the fur trade, that history, helping it transition out of the fur trade and out of the Indian era by facilitating these land transfers, which bring tons of cash into the state or territory, cash that they then themselves can claim. So there's a lot of money to be made in not removing the Indians like you do in, say, Georgia or Alabama, but keeping them in place and negotiating treaty after treaty, which brings cash in, which you can then claim. So that cash becomes a way in which people basically develop the infrastructure of their businesses and the state economy. And it's a way of basically not just taking land, but really taking the wealth and land together, kind of plundering the resources of the indigenous population in order to sort of economically develop the state and territory.
Talking to Columbia University History Professor Michael Witkin about the book Seeing Red, Indigenous Land, American Expansion, and the Political Economy of Plunder in North America. In his work, he focuses a lot on Wisconsin and the surrounding region. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question for our guest about his research and Native history in Wisconsin, the history of U.S. settlement in the region? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking to Michael Witkin about his book, Seeing Red, Indigenous Land, American Expansion, and the Political Economy of Plunder in North America. Let's go to our callers at 800-642-1234. Jeff is with us in Superior. Jeff, hi. Jeff, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Can you hear me,
Jeff?
Now?
Yep, go for it.
Well, this is living history, and it's very exciting to share with you that last year in 2022, we transferred land from the city of Superior, the Diocese of Superior, and the Douglas County back to the Fond du Lac tribe. First time they've owned land in Wisconsin, I think, since the Treaty of 1857. So under the right leadership, you can right some wrongs from the past, and it's an exciting time to remember that, 170 years later or something.
Jeff, thanks for the call. Michael, you are definitely thinking about this history you write about in the present day. What kind of things are you watching for with current land issues related to the descendants of the people you write about?
Well, that's a really interesting story, and I'm interested in those sort of land back sort of movements. A lot of the land in northern Wisconsin and northern Michigan, the UP, is ceded when there really isn't demand for it. There's maybe some demand for mining, some demand for timbering, but a lot of that land has then passed into sometimes public trust for counties or universities or other things. Sometimes it's passed into it was privately owned, but now it's owned. It's public land, and that restoring that kind of land, that's really fascinating to hear that kind of history. I've been interested in that. I think it's also quite interesting that a lot of the land that comes out of these treaties that I mentioned makes its way into the financial instruments that are used to create the land grant colleges in the United States, the Morrill Act, which creates which mandated the creation of a land grant university in all the states in the Union, which is a university that focuses on agricultural training. Those universities are all funded through the Morrill Act, which used basically land that had been ceded by the tribes in the United States that have been turned into financial instruments like a bond and then sold or given back to the states, and the states then cash those land scripts in order to fund the endowments for the land grant universities. Huge amounts of the territory that had been ceded in the 1837 treaty makes its way into the public domain that's then used for funding land grant universities. So, I mean, it's part of the public infrastructure of the United States comes from this transfer of land. And I think reckoning with that and coming to grips with it and finding things like in Superior where you can maybe give the land back if it's possible is a really interesting sort of recognition of this colonial history and sort of undoing some of the legacies of it.
Thanks for that call, Jeff. Michael, I don't want to miss something in your book. It isn't all big picture stuff. You share real people and their stories. One amazing story was leaders from the St. Croix Band of Ojibwe journeying against the advice of federal officials to negotiate directly with President Millard Fillmore in 1852 with some consequences. Can you briefly share that story?
Yeah, that's right. Actually, it was one of my distant relatives was on that trip, and it was a moment where when the treaties had been signed in Wisconsin, one of the provisions that leaders were making was that we won't be removed. And they were saying this is, the era of removal. And they said, well, sign the treaties if you're going to force us, but we want to remain on our land. And so that treaty had been made in 1854. The U.S. government was making plans to go back and remove tribes from northern Wisconsin. And they got wind of it. Some leaders did, as you mentioned, and they sort of snuck off the reservation, made their way to Washington, D.C., and were able to secure an audience with the president and get his commitment to not remove them, to let them stay on their homelands. And so it's a kind of an amazing example of Ojibwe people fighting to remain in their homeland, taking whatever they could in order to preserve that homeland, the territory, that connection to that landscape. And in this case, the journey was kind of amazing. They got stopped in Detroit. The Indian Nation let them go on. They ran out of money in New York. They actually staged a dinner in a New York hotel where they invited people to come in and dine with the Ojibwe chiefs from Lake Superior to fund the rest of the trip to make it to D.C. So it was quite an amazing escapade in the 19th century where Indians were sort of popular cultural figures, but they're also sort of real people fighting to maintain their homeland. And that's part of the story of why Native people in Wisconsin don't get removed. They fought and resisted to stay in their homeland. And I would put a final note, a lot of they brought with them letters from a lot of the towns in Wisconsin on the Superior shoreline who were telling federal government they wanted, in fact, Indians to stay, because they also recognized this political economy of plunder that I was mentioning. And they said, "Our Indians are good neighbors, and so we don't want them removed." So they traveled with letters from non-Native peoples in Wisconsin who were also asking, along with the Ojibwe, to not let them be removed to Indian territory. Pretty amazing story.
Time for one more caller. Nancy is with us in Winneconne. Nancy, hi.
Hi. Thank you. I was in Kalamazoo, Michigan, a few months ago, and there are some historical markers around the city, and they indicated that I believe they were Potawatomi who lived in that area, and they were forced to go west. I don't remember exactly where they had to go, but I recall that they had to leave.
Nancy, thanks for the call. And Michael, do you want to see wider efforts to share the history that you recount in your book, whether it's that public sign or other venues?
Absolutely. I think people don't realize the extent to which the history, particularly the Midwest, is an indigenous history. And American history is really intertwined with indigenous history in a way that can't be separated. So thinking about that is really important. I think thinking about the way that our public lands get created or public universities get created off this kind of colonial relationship is super important. Helping people realize that there's a connection with Native people have to land that still exists today, that's historic, that precedes America, is really important when people see tribes exercising treaty rights, those sorts of things. So I'm all for getting this sort of message, this history out.
Michael, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity.
That's Michael Witkin, professor in the Department of History and the Center for Study of Ethnicity and Race at Columbia University. He's a citizen of the Red Cliff Band of Lake Superior Ojibwe. He was with us today to share his latest book. It's called Seeing Red, Indigenous Land, American Expansion, and the Political Economy of Plunder in North America. That was named a Pulitzer Prize finalist this year. Coming up after the news, we talk about the recent release of Instagram Threads. That's Twitter's newest, potentially most threatening competitor, and what this all means for your social media experience. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. Remember, you can follow these conversations all the time, anytime. Stream live at WPR.org or check out our extremely extensive archives there. You can also download the Wisconsin Public Radio app. You're listening to the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we learn some of the cool history of a hot commodity with the author of a new book on the history of the humble Ice Cube. Now, Facebook parent company Meta released Instagram Threads last week. It's a new text-based social media app. It's an attempt to capture, in part, the significant number of Twitter users who are unhappy with changes made to the platform since its acquisition by Elon Musk. Threads is not the first social media platform to try to entice Twitter users, but so far it seems to be the most successful. Over the weekend, it hit 100 million signups already. Our next guest is here to talk about what Threads has to offer compared to Twitter and other alternatives and how likely it is to come out on top and what it all means for your social media experience. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're curious about this Threads thing, want to figure out if it's right for you, our guest has not one, not two, but three Threads accounts already. If you have been a Twitter user now or in the past, have you noticed changes since Elon Musk entered the picture? Have you been looking for an alternative? Have you tried Threads? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on a different platform, the Ideas Network Facebook page. Steve Knoll is a digital marketing professor specializing in social media at Madison Area Technical College. Steve, welcome back to the studio.
Great for having me again.
Now, Threads, let's start with the new kid here. Steve, what is it doing? How close is it to Twitter? How is it, if in any significant way, different from a Twitter?
Well, the one thing about Threads is that it's not a standalone social media app. It's actually a offshoot of Instagram. You have to have an Instagram account with the Instagram app, then you can download Threads and then link that to Instagram. So, and the idea is that Instagram is about pictures and video, where Threads is going to be more about text and ideas. And so they're meant to be companion pieces. But of course, everybody is talking about, is this the Twitter killer app?
And how, what do you think so far based on what, a week of usage?
Yeah, not even a week. And they've already surpassed 100 million signups. Mm. So it's been a crazy week. So it definitely has some things in common. You know, the big thing about Twitter, the thing that people have always been attracted to Twitter is a social medium that exists in the right now. When you post on Twitter, you're talking about what is happening at this very moment. A lot of social mediums have a lag time to them. Facebook, for example, if I post something right now, you might see it right now. You might not see it till Saturday. Where Twitter was unique in that, you know, anything over 20 minutes or so was considered old news. And there aren't a lot of other social mediums that operate in that real-time moment. Snapchat is probably the closest thing to it. And that's the big question, why will Threads take off and become the next real-time communication tool?
Now, looking at Twitter, it didn't have the numbers. It never had the numbers of Facebook or mm-hmm. Instagram. But we talk about it a lot, I think, because it had an outsized influence, in part because of that immediacy.
Yes.
Can you talk about why we talk about Twitter and what might try to replace it?
Well, and that's the thing is, though, you know, the last time that Twitter reported subscriber numbers, and that was before Elon Musk bought it, it was about 220, 230 million users, which is a very, very large number. But when you consider Instagram as 2 billion users, you know, Twitter was always one-tenth the size of you know, Facebook and Instagram. But that real-time component and the ability to spread the word almost instantly and globally was really an unprecedented tool in the social media arena. And that's the interesting thing is, you know, the last 6 months has been, let's just say, quite interesting watching Twitter. And there has been a question as, you know, Twitter itself is morphing into something different. And even without the rise of Threads, there was question as to whether or not Twitter was sustainable. So it's hard to say that the timing, I think Mark Zuckerberg and Meta lucked out on their timing. Obviously, they didn't just build Threads in 6 months. They've probably been working on this for several years. But they really lucked out in terms of it's the right app at the right time. And I think that is what really translated into this massive growth. But we'll see if it's just a try it and check it out, or if it's going to be an ongoing, I'm going to check it every single day.
Now, what changes have happened at Twitter since Elon Musk bought it that has some users heading for the exit or at least curious enough to try something that does the same sort of stuff?
Well, one of the big things is obviously he has really thrown moderation out the window, you know, and that as a result, there's a lot of it's very complicated to say, a lot of, you know, let's just say it, racists.
Yeah, a lot of Nazis.
Yeah, have really embraced Twitter. All of a sudden, they have a platform and they have a person that says, hey, it's okay to be open about being a Nazi, you know, and as a result, they've really gravitated to Twitter. And as a result, advertisers have really ran away. Because if you're trying to sell paper towels, do you really want your ad right next to the posting of something that's really racist and offensive? So from a business standpoint, you know, Twitter in one way, he said, oh, I want it to be the ultimate free speech tool, and it doesn't matter what the speech is. There's going to be stuff you don't like, but I'm not going to censor anything. Of course, he's already censoring stuff that he doesn't like Threads. There were things last week where he was pulling down stuff already, which I had to kind of chuckle. I'm like, well, the ultimate free speech tool is turned into really the ultimate censorship tool.
Talking to Steve Knoll from Madison College, digital marketing professor there, specializing in social media. We are looking at this new social media platform, Threads, a lot of initial interest. Will that grow? Will that persist? And other efforts to replace Twitter. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What, if anything, is your social media diet? Were you? Are you a Twitter user? Have you looked to something else? Have you tried Threads already? Mastodon, Blue Sky, another one, a T2. The list goes on and on. Join in at 800-642-1234. Steve, before Threads, I dropped a couple other names there. Mm-hmm. There's this Mastodon. It's a little I've peeked at it.
I've tried.
It's a little tricky to get into, but a lot of people, the people who get into it, seem to really like it. It works a little different.
And Blue Sky is another one that is also, you have to get an invitation. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because Blue Sky is being backed by Jack Dorsey, who was one of the CEOs of Twitter before Musk took over. So they're all relatively similar in that they offer a real-time communication platform to, you know, share stuff and talk about stuff. And the whole thing is all really based around this idea of real time. The difference with these other apps is that none of them have really built a critical mass. Blue Sky is probably the biggest competitor, and it's at about 250,000 users. So, you know, Threads is at 100 million users. You know, so when you compare the two of them, it's really hard to get critical mass for like a pop culture moment on such an app that has such small reach. You know, if there's a big moment with a big celebrity and everybody's going online to talk about that, you know, the reach of these smaller apps, it's just not there in order for them to become culturally relevant as a communication tool. I think they want to grow and get there, but they don't really have the backing of something else. You know, Threads had the backing of Instagram and then obviously Meta, Facebook, Mark Zuckerberg. That's a lot of backing, and I think that really gave them the leg up. Having said that, though, you know, Threads is starting to reach the end of its thread in terms of what it does, and I think that was on purpose. I think they're going to release a version 2 very soon. It certainly is missing some stuff. You know, Twitter is still a more attractive platform in terms of what it does, but the content on Twitter has just become so toxic, and that's the big question is what's going to happen there.
Now, one thing I think people who like to be on social media sometimes reach a limit of how much they want the whole world to be participating in their conversation. Mm-hmm. They want to sort of make their own community on whatever that platform is and say, yeah, I don't want to see you and you and you on this platform. I just want to see my buddies and this celebrity I'm following or whatever. How customizable, say, is Threads right now to see what somebody wants to see and forget about the rest?
Well, and that's what's missing, is right now when you go on Threads, you only get their curated stream. And that stream is a combination of people that you do follow along with other people that the algorithm figures out that you probably would have an interest in following. So I've been pleasantly happy as how quickly it figured me out and started recommending stuff that I actually am interested in. I was happy that the stuff that I'm seeing is stuff that I'm interested in, and it's not a lot of junk that I have no interest in. However, I'm definitely missing the ability to just say, hey, I just want to talk to my friends. I just want to talk to these small people. You know, Twitter does offer the ability to, you know, you can look at your followers or you can look at their curated stream. Threads only has the curated stream. This is why I'm convinced this is a version 1 app, because Threads 2.0, which the other question is when will that drop? A week? A month? You know, I think that's the first thing that they'll add to is I think they want people to have, you know, a large built-up following initially. Then they're going to introduce the ability to kind of separate those out and saying, hey, do you want the full everything that's out there, or do you just want to curate your own community? And I think that'll be next, but I just don't know when.
Now, we heard on the Ideas Network Facebook page about Twitter here. Darlene writes, deleted my account the day Elon Musk took over. And John writes, I ditched Twitter the day Elon took over. I don't know. Is there that much visceral reaction just to him, regardless of the changes he made? And are people like loving the warm and cuddly Mark Zuckerberg so much that he's going to draw them to Threads?
I wouldn't call Mark Zuckerberg warm and cuddly. Well, definitely not.
I'm being a little ironical.
Yeah. I mean, you know, and again, Zuckerberg and the whole Meta company with Facebook and Instagram, they definitely have some, you know, privacy issues that have always been ongoing. I've been on here before talking about this stuff that still needs work. You know, the big thing with Musk taking over Twitter is, you know, he really presented himself as this visionary and this humanist. And then once he got his toy, we really learned a new side of him. And he's really showed his cards in terms of how he really feels. And he's really alienated a lot of people. And I think it's ironic that, you know, his other big company is Tesla, an electric company that probably has an audience base of a lot of progressive-minded people. But yet Elon Musk has absolutely embraced the conservative, radical, racist side. And that's unfortunate that he's really embraced that. You know, it's not even like, you know, I'm going to welcome everybody. He's definitely said, I'm going to welcome everybody, but especially these people. And I think that that stuff, A, has absolutely freaked out Madison Avenue in terms of like advertising. And then also it just turned off a lot of people on Twitter. I mean, I'm still on Twitter. I still look at it, but I am probably down to maybe 10% of the time that I spent on it that I was. And a lot of it really is I'm checking Twitter to see how much people are talking about Threads.
We're talking to digital marketing and social media expert Steve Knoll from Madison College, looking at the new Instagram Threads. That's a recently released, in effect, Twitter competitor from Meta. That's the parent company of Facebook. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What social media platforms do you use? What have you moved away from? Are you a current or former Twitter user? What do you think of changes there? Have you sought out the new Threads to try it, or Mastodon, or Blue Sky, or the other potential replacements? Join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your experiences, your questions. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with social media expert Steve Knoll from Madison College about the newest, so far in terms of numbers, most successful entry into the ranks of Twitter competitors, Instagram Threads. Want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. How about you? Have you checked out this new Instagram Threads? Are you going to wait and see if friends and family get onto it? If so, does that make you more or less likely to get onto it yourself? What social media do you like? What do you like about social media? What features do you hate about social media? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Steve, nobody wants to talk to us on the phone about this, but we've heard from some more people online. Marcia wrote, Dear friends, I don't do Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok. Won't be doing Threads. Facebook is all the aggravation I can handle. And I bet Marcy is not alone. I think probably a lot of people have some level of social media burnout or a ceiling on how much they want to invest their time in social media.
Well, and my question is, I always tell people, you don't need to be on social media. This isn't something you have to do. Mm-hmm. But there's definitely a social pressure to be on it. But, you know, Facebook is still the biggest social network. There isn't even a close number two. It's not going anywhere. And, you know, it is designed, you know, for ideas and communication. It's pretty good with video and pictures. It kind of does everything. But, you know, certainly it's not, you know, trendy and exciting. But as a result, Facebook has kind of gravitated to the over 30 audience. But really, that's where the consumers are. And from a money standpoint, I think they're happy about that.
Now, Mark Zuckerberg said something like, talking about Threads here, he'd like a platform like this with a billion or 2 billion people on it. He said something like that. Mm-hmm. Now, with the spread of information as it worked on Twitter, with a much smaller number of people, like, is there a sense that a Meta, right, the Facebook and Instagram company, could sort of track and stop the flow of disinformation on a billion plus platform in a Twitter style?
Well, and that is a big question. The spread of misinformation is an ongoing problem with social media. I think it always will be an ongoing problem. I did have to chuckle over the weekend. I did read some reports about some, let's just say, Nazis who were complaining that they were on Threads and already were getting kicked off. And to me, that kind of made me smile. I'm like, good, because we don't want that stuff on it. And, you know, right now, in order to moderate that stuff, no human being can moderate this stuff. A lot of this moderation has to go through computers first and AI programs doing it. And we've shown that those programs aren't perfect, because a lot of time there's intent behind what is being said. And without that intent, something could be taken out of context. So this is a really complex problem that all the tech companies are working on. So it's always going to be a problem. It's always going to be an issue. Right now, if a big company has to deal with this, I'm glad it's Meta. you know, they're far from perfect. They definitely have issue, but I think that they're the ones that are trying the hardest, even though they're not perfect, you know. And then you only ever hear about when they mess up. You never hear when they succeed. You only hear about when they mess up. But if you really look at their hit to miss ratio, it's pretty good, you know, compared to Twitter, which is basically a dumpster fire at this point. So again, it's not a problem. Now, again, can they scale this up to 2 billion users? Ooh, you know, that's kind of a freaky thing. But, you know, they're at 100 billion and they haven't, 100 million. Mm-hmm. Add a few zeros. And there haven't been any, like, reports of outages or crashes, you know, anything significant like that. That's impressive. For an app launching virtually with no problem, that does show that they've got some infrastructure behind this.
Now, how about, this is something we've been talking about for years, Steve, privacy and our personal mm-hmm. information. Is there anything about, you know, leaping onto a new platform like Threads that's going to give up more about us than we're already giving up if, say, we're just on Facebook?
No. You have to remember, this isn't a new platform. This is a spinoff mm-hmm. of Instagram. So if you're on Instagram, if you have your privacy settings set, which I'm going to say it again, people need to check their privacy settings. If you have that stuff turned on, if you've got it curated as to what you're comfortable with sharing, Threads will follow what Instagram is doing. It's not collecting anything new. It's not doing anything that Instagram isn't already doing. So if you feel safe and comfortable with Instagram, you should feel safe and comfortable with Threads. The biggest problem right now is consumers and users just do not take the time and effort to make sure their settings are set properly and that they understand what the apps are collecting and curating that information. That's up to the users. You can't complain that these companies are like following you around when you're not taking the time to properly set them up.
Now let's talk about what gets served up to us by the algorithms here. Mm-hmm. I haven't done Threads yet myself. Mm-hmm. Maybe I never will. I don't know. But as you mentioned, the algorithm gives us suggested for us stuff based on our other mm-hmm. thread follows. And I see on Facebook, there's, you know, my friends, there's my groups. Great. Mm-hmm. They're sponsored. All right. I know somebody's giving money there. And then they're suggested for you.
Mm-hmm.
By who? The algorithm. There, like, do we know what's in the black box that says, yeah, Rob, you got to see this?
Well, you can actually go into your account and see the listing of all the stuff that it's using to create those. Suggestions. It's actually quite fascinating to go in there and look that. If you go into your account setting, mm-hmm. you can actually see that stuff. So now the one thing about Threads that is definitely not there, advertising.
Yet.
And that's why I'm also convinced this is a version one, because there's no way that this will not have advertising. But I think they want to really give people a commercial-free experience initially. Also, too, they probably need to figure out, you know, and I think it's interesting how even though Threads is a companion to Instagram, I'm already going through and curating my Threads account to be different from my Instagram account in terms of who I'm following, in terms of who I'm allowing to follow me. So I think that that's part of it. I don't want to say this is a beta period, but I think that that's what they're doing, is they're letting people kind of get comfortable with it before they introduce these other features, before they introduce advertising. And also, too, I have to admit, you know, within a few minutes of setting up Threads, it was already figuring out what I like. And it was figuring out in a way that I was happy with. It was showing me stuff I actually wanted to see. And that made me impressed.
Just our last minute or so, Steve, what is on your eye that maybe isn't in the media yet in social media? What is on the horizon you're watching?
Well, the big question is, Twitter is obviously threatening to sue mm-hmm. Threads and shut that down. I think that's just showing that Twitter is definitely terrified of this. Now, you know, Twitter doesn't have to release numbers anymore. They don't have to release subscribers now that it's privately held. But, you know, people who look at, like, data and how much internet data is going to the Twitter website, in the last 3 months, Twitter has absolutely been on a downward spiral. But the last 5 days, it has fallen off a cliff. And for anyone that's an investor, anyone that's an advertiser, this is some really shocking numbers. So my big question, what's on the horizon, is really not about Threads. It's really what's going to happen to Twitter, because it's not sustainable. So we'll see. It's either that or they're going to introduce holograms.
Steve, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us again.
Great. Thanks for having me.
That's Steve Knoll, digital marketing professor specializing in social media at Madison Area Technical College. He joined us to talk about the recent entry of Instagram Threads into the social media landscape. Still time for you to share your thoughts over on the Ideas Network Facebook page, or you can email ideas@wpr.org. Are you an early adopter, or are you going to wait and see, or just plain forget about it? Post on the Ideas Network Facebook page or email ideas@wpr.org. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, a related issue, social media scams are on the rise, including on Facebook Marketplace. Find out what's going on and how to stay safe when you buy and sell stuff online. That's tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Aurora Borealis at this time of year in this part of the country, localized partly within our state. Yes, it could happen here. Most of Wisconsin may have a shot at seeing the northern lights in a couple days. As reported in Smithsonian Magazine, the Geophysical Institute at the University of Alaska Fairbanks includes Wisconsin in the forecast for a look at the northern lights this Thursday night into early Friday morning. Now, it's not a sure thing. These forecasts are updated daily. The lights come from solar flare activity interacting with the Earth's electromagnetic field. Mostly, you got to be further north to see them, but they can spread when conditions are right. If you want to see it this Thursday, make plans to get away from lights as much as possible and hope for clear weather. And join the show earlier in the day on Thursday. We're going to talk about the lights and other things to watch for in the summer sky. And hopefully, come Thursday night, Aurora Borealis comes in view. Enjoy it with some steamed hams. This is Central Time.